It's my great pleasure to introduce David Baxter. David Baxter is a person who probably knows BC as well as any other citizen of British Columbia. He's a demographer. He's an economist. Some people call him a futurist. I don't really call him a futurist as much as a person who understands and knows what's going on in British Columbia and indeed in much of the world today. Understands what's going on, and from the basis of what's going on, says if these trend lines continue, here are some implications. David is working right now in the Fort St. John, Dawson Creek area, Terrace area, Middle Vancouver Island. He said to me just a few minutes ago that he's probably had dinner or breakfast or lunch in every Smitty's in B.C., probably every Tim Hortons as well. He knows B.C. very, very well. And rather than take up time, it is my great pleasure now to present to you David Baxter.
Having eaten in every Smitty's is not necessarily a recommendation. It's merely a fact. I do a lot of work that takes me into not only the sort of the urban areas of rural British Columbia, if you like, the big small towns, but also into communities like Clearwater and Telqua and Tumbler Ridge and places like that. And one of the things I experience is, as somebody in Terrace on Monday put it, so much geography, so few people. We took off from here in Hawk Air's wonderful little Dash 8 and flew into 100-mile headwind, so we were an hour late getting there. Once we crossed the North Shore, we didn't fly over anybody's house until we reached the Alaska Panhandle. So it gives you a feeling of the issues in British Columbia. What I've to try and structure some of these issues for tonight, what I've done is taken the theme of diversity. British Columbia is the most diverse province in Canada on a whole bunch of dimensions, and that introduces a whole bunch of challenges for people, for representation, for democracy. So what I'd like to do tonight is kind of juggle between some really geeky stuff. Jack was being polite. I'm actually just a geek. And some of the policy stuff and trying to capture what some of that means. So a lot of our stuff is on our website. It's urbanfutures.com, and you can browse at it at your leisure if you wish. There's the challenge I was trying to respond to, which was Charles de Gaulle's challenge of how do you govern in a country which has 246 different kinds of cheese. I guess our challenge to govern is that 79% of the province of British Columbia has fewer than one person for every 10 square kilometers living in it. So a different kind of challenge. So I took as my theme democracy and diversity. Diversity has been something everybody sort of felt great about diversity for a while, and they had the image that we were all going to sit around the campfire and hold hands and sing folk songs in a diverse society. And people are now saying that's not true. I don't feel nearly as comfortable in a diverse society. I don't feel nearly as represented in a diverse society. So a lot of stuff coming out of both the United States and Britain right now is questioning the ideas of diversity and saying that people feel less represented in a diverse society than they do in a homogeneous society. And that's absolutely true if you're part of the homogeneity. So that if you're part of the ones that are in charge, it's cool, but if you're not, if you speak a different language or you're gay or you have a different style of living, you probably don't feel as comfortable in a homogeneous society that you're not part of. So that diversity debates are now going into their second generation, where people are saying the reality of diversity is that it's not going to make us feel particularly comfortable, but it may make us feel safe. So that's the issues in rethinking diversity. British Columbia doesn't have the choice to become a homogeneous society because geography itself makes us a diverse province, makes us the most diverse region in North America because of the spatial distribution of our population. It's very difficult to represent this graphically, but there's some landmarks. That's North America at night, and there's Fort St. John, Prince George, Vancouver, Kelowna. If we take away the labels for a minute, we see some very interesting patterns in it. There is the prairies, or there are the prairies, Winnipeg, Saskatoon, Regina, Edmonton, Calgary, and all the people on the road between Edmonton and Calgary. Yeah, or it was the Oilers and the Flames, and they're all going to fight in Red Deer. That's my hometown right there, Red Deer. But if you look at that pattern, pretty uniform distribution of pattern throughout all of the prairies, right up into the Peace River country. Ontario, it doesn't really matter. You're all down the Golden Horseshoe. Same in Quebec down in the south. Look at British Columbia. Southeast corner, the Okanagan, up the Thompson-Fraser Valley, across into the Skeena Basin, out to Terrace. Our population distribution in British Columbia looks like a string of Christmas tree lights. It's not like a distribution you see anywhere else in North America in terms of a political jurisdiction. And so that imposes, this huge amount of space, imposes diversity on our communities that we don't see elsewhere. If we do it the way a geographer would see it, there's all of the places where people live in Canada, colored by their region, so forgetting political boundaries. And you can see that huge uniformity on the prairies, the line that is British Columbia. And then, of course, we go and impose on these maps political boundaries that really don't match much of their geography or their reality. And so we see a pattern that goes from this, come on, computer, to that, which is political representation in Canada. So BC becomes very unique. I've done a fair amount of work in Alberta, and they had what they called a value survey done. And they surveyed the people in the province of Alberta and said, what are the things that make you feel sort of part of the province of Alberta? And they found an enormous similarity between people in Alberta, a very homogeneous set of values, of interests, because they essentially live in a relatively homogeneous region, a flat plain with a road that goes east every mile and a road that goes south every mile. And so it's not hard to be kind of uniform in Alberta, except with respect to hockey. Another way we could look at it is to take a look at the density of population settlement, how many people there are per square kilometer. And again, you can see Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, really fairly uniform distribution. Of course, Southern Ontario, continuous. And British Columbia, again, a very low density and very little connection between the settlements in the province of British Columbia. So we become diverse because we are essentially separate from each other. There's putting the dots for BC back on the map, and you can see that string of lights phenomena, the peace country up in the, I'd like to say up in the north, but the peace is sort of in the middle. It's great. You're going to go up to Prince George, and Prince George calls itself the capital of the north. Of course, it's in the southern half of the province, but they don't worry about that in Prince George. So there's the issue. And you say, well, why would we choose to settle like that? Well, we choose to settle like that because we live in the river valleys throughout. Once we get up into the Peace River country, population settlement is very much like the settlement pattern you see on the prairies, fairly uniform. But in the rest of the province, we settle in the Fraser Valley, the Thompson Valley, the Okanagan Valley, the Columbia Valley, and then the connection between the Fraser-Thompson Valley and out to the coast at Prince Rupert into the Skeena Basin. So really, geography imposes on us isolation, if you like, or separation, which you don't find anywhere else in Canada. Sort of similar in Newfoundland. Newfoundland is having an oil. Some people from Newfoundland are coming here, going up to Terrace next week, and they're going to talk about how the oil and gas industry can benefit communities. One of the questions was put to them is, how did the communities in the interior of Newfoundland benefit from the oil and gas industry? And the guy said, we don't have any. There are no communities in the center of Newfoundland. Every community in Newfoundland's on the coast. So a similar kind of geographically imposed separation. In trying to express what that means in terms of people's feelings and engagement in the province, BC Stats, you can get this from their website, but it's a dot map, that's one dot for every 50 people, and it sort of captures it, except it makes the Okanagan look almost like the lower mainland. It's got a lot of little blue dots there. So what we did is a different map. we just took the percentage of the population in each region, and that's the Lower Mainland from here to Flintstone Village up by Popcom on the Trans-Canada Highway just before Hope. 57% of British Columbia's population lives in the Lower Mainland on 4.5% of its land area. So an enormous concentration of the majority of the province of British Columbia lives in one community. If we roll in Victoria, two-thirds of British Columbia's population lives in two communities on 4.6% of its land area. So we're talking about any kind of majority of representation is going to be dominated by two communities. It's just the way the geography works. If we put in Nanaimo, Kelowna, Kamloops, and Prince George, which have about between 2 and 4% of the province's population, those six communities encompass 75% of our population, and we're still only at under 8% of the province's land area. It's a very low-density settlement pattern with enormous concentration in the Lower Mainland. If we roll all of the major urban areas, get all 20 major urban areas in the province on the map, we managed to capture 87% of its population living in 16% of its land area. So a province of very low densities, if we put everybody who lives in British Columbia, we wind up with 79% of the province having less than one person every 10 square kilometers. So very, very distinct pattern, significant concentration in one community, and once you get out of that community, you're really talking about spatially isolated communities in river bottoms where rivers join. So that, if you like, the first part of it, is why British Columbia is always going to feel tensions, if you like, regional tensions that you're not going to find elsewhere in Canada. You get rivalry between Regina and Saskatoon, but there's not enough people to really worry about. Edmonton, Calgary, same thing, rivalry, but there's really the same communities. Toronto owns the world, so you don't have to worry about that. You just don't get that spatial separation in other parts of Canada or other parts. The United States is much more fortunate because they just cut their country up into a whole bunch of little blobs, so they tend to be relatively closer to their governance unit. So that's the first part of my talk. The second thing I was asked to look at is, who are we as a people? So we're spatially separate, but what characterizes us as a community or as a people? So I first want to take a look at our diversity here in contrast to other parts of Canada, to see sort of how we are distinguished from other parts of Canada. But I have to raise a few issues when I go into this, or a few points before I look at the numbers to set a context. First of all, as soon as we start talking about diversity or measuring or that sort of stuff, we start defining people. And so who we are becomes a function of our definitions. And the data we always use tends to be one-dimensional. So we capture one part of a person or one part of a community, but we can't really characterize the entire community. People are multidimensional. So an example I always use to kind of carry this, explain the difficulty of conveying diversity in a community, is we have these labels like female, Muslim, feminist, immigrant, visible minority, Vancouver kid, Torontonian, media star, ethnic, Gen Xer, African, Indian, author, and Canadian are various ways we could define people. But when we look at the reality, it's one person. It's a person who is all of those things or none of them, so that when we try and discuss who this person is and what community they belong to, we find a great deal of complexity. So in order to talk about diversity, I'm going to have to simplify things. And I just raise that as I don't want to make things stereotypical. So what do our communities look like? Well, they're older folks, happy, smiling couple from Grand Forks or somewhere. But they don't always act the way older folks are supposed to act. They do things that may not be part of our image. They, for example, engage in reckless behavior, driving around in convertibles without seat belts or roll bars. Whether they're young or old, it's one of these female automobile things, I guess. So we see diversity in behavior beyond what we expect. We see people doing things who come from different places that we don't make. A Swedish car company with somebody who speaks Cantonese as a customer service representative. So we see these, what Marshall McLuhan talked about is things brushing together that we don't anticipate, the sparks that that might create. A situation where in Western Canada, our rural communities, very significantly younger population of First Nations ancestry, so that we have to take a look when we talk about young people between urban and rural areas, we're talking about different ancestry backgrounds. But perhaps when we talk about Canadians, we should look at this group of Canadians. Anybody here recognize these guys? From Saskatoon. Yeah. They're from Saskatoon. From is the operative word always with Saskatoon. And it's Widemouth Mason, a great rock blues band from Saskatoon. The last good band to come out of Saskatoon was Humphrey and the Dump Trucks, which are good. They're a great band. Bear Miller is the guy who's the head of Humphrey, or the leader of Humphrey and the Dump Trucks. But these are guys from Saskatoon who've named their band after a pickle jar. Mason jars? Well, the Mason jars with big mouths are Widemouth Mason. Saskatoon band. How would we characterize them? How would they characterize themselves? Are they ethnic people? Are they from Asian, South Asian, Chinese, and I guess Scandinavian ancestry? So when we look at people, we have this challenge of how do we regard them? They define themselves as Canadians. Musicians, whatever. But when we look at the data, that's another complexity for Canada, is how we define ourselves and our population. We get a chance to define ourselves each year on the census, every 5 years on the census. Up till 1991, we were not allowed to say we were Canadian on the census form. We had to say we were of Scottish ancestry or British ancestry or Indian ancestry or something. We couldn't. But in 1991, 96, and 2001, we were allowed to enter Canadian. And it turns out that in British Columbia, the second largest ethnic group is the Canadians. I don't think it's about hockey, but it may be. Rapidly growing ethnic group, grew by 15%. Largest ethnic group, English. Followed that Canadian, Scottish, Irish, German, Chinese, French, Aboriginal, East Indian, Dutch, Ukrainian, going down through the list with various different growth rates. Amazing, something nobody sort of hasn't played out in the landscape, but the fastest growing ancestry group in British Columbia right now is people of Korean ancestry. So when the Koreans made it to the final round of the World Cup and all the people of Korean ancestry were out celebrating on the streets on Robson Street, et cetera, everybody said, why are the Chinese people all so happy? Because we haven't built the Korean community into our analysis. The strength of this picture, if you like, or the difficulty, is that wide, wide range of what people define their ancestries as. But the really interesting thing is almost half of the people in British Columbia say they're of multiple ancestry. So 56% say they're of single ancestry, but 44% say that they are of Scottish, Dutch, First Nation, Chinese, South Asian, American ancestry. And by the way, in the last census, you were allowed to put down Newfoundlander as an ethnic group. I don't make this stuff up. It's all in the data. So we are a very diverse population in terms of how we define ourselves, how we define our ancestry. My ancestors on my mother's side came to Canada in 1726. So I, wherever they came from, I don't identify with that at all. But my father came from Scotland. And I always, when asked, you know, what my ancestry is, put down Canadian, because if I put down Scottish, it means I have to maybe go back and wear women's clothes or whatever people do in Scotland. So I'm pretty careful about what ancestry I put down. If we take a look at our history of diversity in British Columbia and Canada, we see that in Canada as a whole, we've always been about one out of five of us born outside the country. So that's the definition of statistics Canada uses. So somewhere 1911, about 20% of us, 22% people in Canada were foreign born. 2001, it was about 18%. If we go back and say, well, what kind of change? Well, we perceive a lot of change. In fact, over the last 30 years, the mix in Canada as a whole hasn't particularly changed in terms of our birthplaces. We're more likely to be Canadian-born now than we were in 1971. 61% of us, both parents were born in Canada. About 16% of us are a first generation. One of our parents was born, at least one born outside the country. And 22% in 2001, 25% were people who were born outside of Canada. But if we go back and look at our history, in 1911, 57% of the people in Alberta and British Columbia were born outside Canada. So 1911, Alberta, British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, high levels of populations who were born outside of Canada. And it's declined continuously since then as our provinces became more settled. So now that we've got British Columbia and Ontario, both with about 27% of the population born outside the country, and then the other provinces slightly less than average, Atlantic provinces, only about 3% of the people born outside of Canada in the Atlantic provinces. But remember that Atlantic provinces and Saskatchewan are sources of population for other provinces, so they tend not to be destinations. People always say, gee, why don't immigrants go and live in Saskatchewan? And I can give you 500 reasons why they don't have a hockey team. So the places that have not grown clearly do not have a large proportion of their population who immigrate to this country because they don't have a large population of us either. So the issue is very much rapidly growing areas. Alberta, British Columbia, and Ontario tend to have a higher proportion of immigrant population than more slowly growing regions. Ooh, back up. It's not meant to be a preview. So if we take a look at then another dimension of this, British Columbia and Ontario, first of all, I guess I have to say, three-quarters of the people living in both provinces were born in the country. So I've chopped the bottom off the scale. We're starting at 75%. So we're overwhelmingly Canadian-born, but we tend to be, because of our economic growth, we tend to be the largest destinations for people who immigrated to Canada. Both people who immigrated to Canada prior to 1991, so long-term immigrants, and then people who immigrated to Canada more recently within the last decade. So about 1 out of 10 of us, 1 out of 10 of the people in Ontario, came to these provinces within the previous 10 years, about 1 out of 20 in the province of Alberta, and then in the other provinces as well. He didn't say Dada, did he? I've done it. Never again. What has changed is where we were born. So the fact that we have been born outside of the country isn't the distinguishing feature for British Columbia. It's that if we go back to 1941, had almost exactly the same pattern in terms of people being born outside, this is the case of the Lower Mainland, but in 1941, 31% of the population was born in Europe. In 2001, 24% of the population was born in Asia. So we have always been a province of people who immigrated, but now we're immigrating from different places. And it ties into a whole bunch of issues, including the fact that all of the countries in Europe have a below the replacement level birth rate, so they don't have large younger populations for immigration. Our sources of immigration change over time, even over very short periods of time. In 1996, major sources of immigration were Hong Kong and Taiwan. By 2001, it had become the People's Republic of China and India, followed by the Philippines and Korea. So changing patterns not over the very long period, but also in the shorter period of time. This raises a whole bunch of issues. The discussion of population and immigration is not without its controversies. This is an article by the Fraser Institute that says Vancouver could see race riots. Cities with existing immigrant populations feel overwhelmed. I'm not troubled about this because I don't think my proctologist has got time to riot. But nevertheless, it has been raised. But what I wanted to raise out of this is a quote that says, the arrival of so many parents talking about our immigrant population now causes a problem because immigrants now could, the old constitute a considerably higher proportion of Canada's population than they do of the general population. So there's an issue here being raised about immigration that is wrong, factually wrong, but it's something that enters into the discussion of immigration. And because we are a province where there is a large number of people who were born outside, we have to deal with this issue if we're going to deal with the issue of diversity. So the question we have to deal with is, where do all the old immigrants come from? Because it's a fundamental issue to the discussion of diversity in British Columbia. If we look at the data, it is true that over half of the immigrant population is over the age of 45. So that is a fact. It looks, therefore, like the immigrant population is older than that of the resident population, but we have to take a look at what an immigrant is defined as in Statistics Canada. Statistics Canada says you're an immigrant if you're born outside of Canada. How many people here are born outside of Canada? How many of you feel like immigrants? Okay, so it's a definition. When they say immigrant, they mean foreign-born, but that enters into then the discussion of immigrants in our community. So that the fact that the Hungarian freedom fighters came to Canada in 1956 puts them in as old immigrants in the data, even though they happen to have been here for some 50 years. So if we take a look and ask the question, when people came to Canada as immigrants, of the population that came to Canada before 1961, almost 100% of them are over the age of 45. Well, I should hope so. Because they came 50 years ago. They better be over the age of 45. If not, they've got something going for them that I want to know about. So there's where we get caught in this definitional issue, where we start making judgments so that we go in to Mackenzie. You go into Mackenzie, go to the mall. There's actually two in Mackenzie. And in the middle of that mall, there are a significant number of old gentlemen wearing turbans speaking Punjabi, who have been working in the forest industry in British Columbia since 1950. We take a look at the history of logging in British Columbia. The logging communities of British Columbia were peopled by the people of Japanese ancestries who worked in the mill, Sikhs who worked on the green chain, Franco-Canadians who worked in it. So you go out to Millardville, and there's parts of that community that have the first Sikh temples in the Fraser Valley and those sorts of things. So when we look at the issue of immigration, we have to always remember that it's been with us for 158 years. So that, of course, we're going to have old foreign-born populations because they came a long time ago. The first Prime Minister of Canada, Sir John A. Macdonald, was defined as an immigrant for his entire life by Statistics Canada. So when we take... Whoops, back up. Come on, David. When we take a look at that profile and we say, well, what about the immigrants who came in the last 10 years, 1991 to 2001? They are much younger than the resident population. So that only 6% are over the age of 65 compared to 10% of our population that's over the age of 65. Immigration is a really tough process. It is something that young people do much better than old people. I am not going to immigrate anywhere. I am not going to go to Tuscany or the south of France or anything because I need my pillow. Okay. So immigration is for the young, and the data show that it's for the young. If we do look at the foreign-born population and find out who comprises the older foreign-born population, of course it's people born in Europe. Because that was the dominant immigrant group to Canada in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. So when my father came here, he was in that immigrant group. And when we look at the younger foreign-born population, much more greater proportion of them, of younger foreign-born people, born in Asia, because that's the current stream of immigration as the population of Europe ages and they don't have many migrants. So the age profile of current immigrants to British Columbia is overwhelmingly younger than the resident population, because when you're young, you've got the mobility to do so. So the answer to the question of where did all the old immigrants come from is they came as young immigrants a long time ago. And you will find it striking when you go into a community like Williams Lake with a very strong Sikh community. They've been working in the sawmills in Williams Lake. The immigration is not something that is lower mainland specific. Sikhs have been working in the forests of British Columbia for 100 years. So they are expressed in our communities. If we take a look at another dimension, in British Columbia, we are also the closest to immigration in the sense of we have the highest percentage of population who has a parent who was an immigrant. So British Columbia is quite different from Newfoundland or New Brunswick or Nova Scotia in terms of their relationship to a larger world, because we tend to be much more connected with a larger world because our parents came, one or more of our parents came from somewhere else in the world. So I have a deep, passionate interest in Scotch, in the Scottish... in the Scottish community, because I have a parent who came from there. So British Columbia, another characteristic of our community then is that we are also tend to be much more strongly oriented to tensions in the world than you find people in Nova Scotia or Quebec or those kinds of regions. In terms of religion, we tend to be much more diverse, which is to say that we tend not to have the same concentration of population in a particular religious group as we would find in other parts of Canada. So that the leading religion in the province of British Columbia is none. And the reason we have the church of you do not have to get up on Sunday morning. So the single most frequent response when you ask somebody in British Columbia what their religion is, huh. So 35% of us have no religion, compared to about 13% in in Canada as a whole. 47% of the population of Canada says they're Roman Catholic. Because we don't have that concentration in one religion, we tend to have a different pattern in all our other religions. So we have a little bit more in terms of Baptists and Lutherans and Sikhs and Buddhists and other Protestants. A little bit lower in terms of Muslim, a little bit higher in terms of Mennonite. It sort of bounces around. So we are more religiously diverse than other parts of Canada as well. And our closest neighbor is Ontario because of their diverse population as well. If we compare our 13% of our population in British Columbia to our share of the various religions, we have half of the Sikh population in Canada. But we only have 5% of the Roman Catholic population. So we have a disproportionate share of no religions, Anglicans, other Christians, Sikh, Baptist, Lutheran, Buddhist, other Protestant, not a proportionate share of Muslims, a proportionate share of Pentecostal. We're a little low on Pentecostals, but we're a little rich on Jehovah's Witnesses. So again, the issue is a pattern where there really isn't a pattern. It's a pattern of significant diversity, which makes it more difficult to find community, if you like, out of a religion. We have another concept that data is collected, which is the visible minority population. This is my favorite. This is one Statistics Canada made up. So you don't get to say whether you're visible minority or not. How many people here know Biff Naked? Not Stark, but Biff. She has more tattoos in more places than I have places. She also has more metal objects going through parts of her body than I have body parts. But she's very, very much a minority, and she's very visible. But Statistics Canada does not consider her so. A visible minority is a person other than Aboriginal people who are non-Caucasian in race or non-white in color. So we have this concept of visible minority, which, of course, in Vancouver, Burnaby, and Richmond, the visible minority is actually the visible majority. In Cantonese, white people are referred to as Lo Fan, or ghosts. So we are the invisible non-minority. This stuff gets really complicated after a while. So one of the really great things that's happening in Canada is I think by the next census we will have lost the concept of visible minority. But when we look at it, clearly it's associated with the younger population because of the recent immigrant flow being the younger population. So almost one out of three people aged 15 to 24 in the province of British Columbia are classified by Statistics Canada as part of a visible minority. So two-thirds of Widemouth Mason are in there. But it's younger, so that when we talk about issues of participation in a culture, participation in society, a group of young people will have quite a different take on it than a group of people my age showed up in the visible minority data. But when we look at the visible minority data, we find that there's a huge diversity in the visible minority population. So 11% of that 15 to 24 age, 12% are of Chinese ancestry. Of course, if they speak Hokkienese rather than Cantonese or Mandarin, they can't talk to any other people anyhow unless they talk in English. It's great. If you go to work in, I used to teach in Southeast Asia. And if you work in Southeast Asia, you get this great thing of being able to watch Japanese, Korean, people from Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Thailand sit around drinking beer and make fun of the Australians. But they can only do it in English because it's the only common language they have. So tremendous diversity. When we talk about the South Asian population, that includes people from Pakistan, Sri Lanka, India, Afghanistan, all of those ranges of cultures and communities. So a tremendous diversity even within this relatively diverse society. Another measure of diversity is we have overwhelmingly the highest propensity to be involved in intermarried couples, the Statistics Canada definition, different visible minority groups, or one visible, one non-visible minority marriage. These things can be lethal, folks. I'm married to a very charming woman from Saskatoon who still believes that there's a CCF party. And I'm from Red Deer, Alberta, where we grew up hearing about the Alberta Rat Patrol. How many people remember the Alberta Rat Patrol? To make sure the rats didn't get in from Saskatchewan, exactly. Couldn't have made my point better. So the issue is we also tend to be much more diverse in terms of the families we establish than we find in other communities. Even CCFers. We tend to be a relatively old province. Median age, half the people in British Columbia are over the age of 38. That puts us up there with Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Quebec, New Brunswick. Relatively old province. But that's not particularly old. What makes us look relatively old is that we're right next to the province of Alberta, which is the youngest province in Alberta, which, of course, has got a large proportion of our young people who migrated there over the last few years. So you can actually see a Canucks jersey in Calgary. Rarely, but you can see it. So relatively old, but we have one of the oldest rural and small town populations in Canada. So in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, much younger small town populations. Our small town populations tend to be older, but of course it's comprised of two kinds of small towns. One is the retirement communities like Oliver, which are very, very old. The other end of the spectrum, we have Peace River, Fort St. James, those kinds of places that are quite young families, young working population. So within that statistic, again, significant spatial diversity. But the reason Alberta is young is that's interprovincial migration from Alberta to BC and from BC to Alberta. And from 1996 till the last quarter of 2003, British Columbia lost people to the province of Alberta every quarter. And those people are overwhelmingly young. So it made us older and made British Alberta younger. So again, it's something driven by, we may civilize Alberta yet. In terms of life expectancy, we have the oldest life the longest life expectancy of all of the provinces. Life expectancy for a male in British Columbia is 77.3 years, a female 82.6, older than the other provinces. Of course, people from the other provinces moving here, it doesn't mean they'll live longer. You know, you can't kind of juggle it. But long life expectancy, driven by a whole bunch of things, lifestyle, the nature of our communities, those sorts of things. To have the lowest birth rate in Canada, a typical woman during her lifetime in British Columbia has 1.4 children. You need 2 children to replace a population. If a woman has fewer than 2 children during her lifetime, on average, your population becomes older because you have fewer young people added to a population. So Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba have younger populations in part because they have higher birth rates. There's British Columbia's birth rate pattern. In 1958, the typical woman in the province of British Columbia had 4 children during her lifetime. 1967, the incredible technological advance that changed birth patterns dramatically. Multi-channel television came in. Birth rates plunged. And we're now at the rate of about 1.4 children per woman to her lifetime. It's a very significant number. It is causing tensions around the world. Europe has a below the replacement level birth rate, as does Canada. The United States has a replacement level birth rate. As a result, in order to maintain its labor force, Europe will need 100 million immigrants over the next 50 years. Spain has a birth rate of 1.1 children per woman during her lifetime. The United States has a higher birth rate than Canada. It has a replacement level birth rate, but it has that replacement level birth rate because it has a large and growing Hispanic population. They don't have children because they're Hispanic, because we have J-Lo as evidence. So a woman will not have any children. She'll have 4.4 marriages. But because their immigrant population overwhelmingly comes from rural areas. So when we look within British Columbia, we see the same pattern. Much higher birth rates in rural areas than in urban areas. So a whole different set of issues that emerge out of the birth rate data. We've tracked Canada almost precisely. We've been below Canada for the last decade in terms of birth rates. But the really interesting thing about British Columbia is we had a very low birth rate up till 1951. And the reason we had a very low birth rate up to 1951 is you didn't come to British Columbia unless you were going to cut down trees, catch fish, or work in a mine. So we had a very high proportion of our population was male, relatively few females, so we had a very low birth rate. After the war, when we shifted to an urban community, we moved up to the Canadian pattern. Another issue affecting change in our community is that not only are birth rates dropping, but women are having children later in their lives. So in 1961, when the typical woman had 4 children during her lifetime, she had them between the ages of 20 and 24. Now, the typical woman giving birth in British Columbia is a 30-year-old. So it changes the entire dynamic of families, of the workplace, of school use, all of that stuff driven by this change in fertility patterns. We have a lower birth rate than Canada as a whole, but we tend to have a higher birth rate in the older age groups than the rest of Canada. So our issues with young population are different. I don't have a... They stopped asking this question on the Canadian census. They ask dumb questions and keep them, and they drop the good questions. But percentage of women who never had a child during their lifetimes. This is American data. We argue that it's got to be about the same for Canada. But in 1980 in the United States, only 10% of the female population went through their lifetime without having a child. It's now 20% of the population. 1 out of 5 women in the United States, it's got to be roughly the same or more in Canada because we have a lower birth rate, are never having a child. So we talk about empty nesters, but we have a huge population of never nesters. And that again brings implications, for example, who should pay for schools. All of those kinds of things get entered into the debate coming from relatively simple demographic material. How do children in British Columbia live compared to the rest of Canada? About the same. The big outlier in Canada in terms of children living by living arrangements is the province of Quebec. But in British Columbia, 72% of the children 0 to 14 live with married parents. 8% live in common law couples, and 21%, not 10%, Jack, it was 21, yeah, 21%. So one out of five children in British Columbia under the age of 15 are living in a single-parent household. Not dramatically different from the other provinces of Canada, but again, an issue that plays into both the demand for services and the seeking of representation in a democracy. Real change in families in British Columbia. Over the last 20 years, the number of 20 to 29-year-olds living in their parents' home in British Columbia, the percentage has doubled. 40% of the 20 to 29-year-olds in British Columbia live in their parents' home. What do you call a 26-year-old male living in their parents' home? Fridge magnet. So the issue is our families are dramatically different now. We have suburbs where the houses look like parking lots because they were built for a one-car, one-wage earner family, and they now have four wage earners. And because two of the wage earners aren't paying rent somewhere else, they have much nicer cars than their parents do. Like a dramatic example of unfairness. And my daughter drives an SUV, and my 1990 Nissan is rusting out. So a change in the kinds of how families work. We have different kinds of families now than we had 20 years ago. It's a pattern common throughout Canada. Quebec, you tend to have a relatively low percentage of 20 to 29-year-olds living with their parents. Toronto, Hamilton, St. Catharines, Oshawa, St. John's, Vancouver, Chicoutimi, Thunder Bay, Windsor, Greater Sudbury, there's... I want to go to Lesser Sudbury sometime. Abbotsford, Montreal, Kitchener. Significant portion of young people living in their parents' home. I left home when I was 16. It was a race to the door. My parents were going to go for the divorce court, and I was going, period. Now kids hang around till they're 29, 30. I think they're trying to wait us out, but I'm not sure. Why are they doing that? Because we've changed the whole structure of education. Percentage of kids living at home in British Columbia, the 20 to 24 age group, Vancouver, I should say, percentage of kids living at home in the 20 to 24 age group has gone from 48% to 62%, 25 to 29 almost doubled, 16 to 25%. The probability that they're working has gone down, not significantly, but has dropped. But what has gone up to match that drop is that they're getting an education. So as our education requirements to get jobs, to get employment go up, our kids stay at home longer, they have children later, and we get a dramatic change in the texture of families and what families mean. An example, are these families in strife? No, they tend to be families that get along pretty well together. They all listen to Santana turned up loud. Young people, because they listen to music loud. Older people listen to Santana loud because they listened to it loud when they were younger people and they damaged their hearing. So here's an example of these households. Young lad says to his father, "Your inner dad just kicked your butt." Who's your inner dad? My inner dad is like having your grandpa inside me to keep me in line. Kid says, "Well, when I'm your age, who will be my inner dad, you or grandpa?" And dad says, "Well, I think it'll be me." Kid says, "Sweet." Look at the grip on the channel changer, guys. Look at the grip. Is that not a role model for a young person? You know, it's in the right hand. It's the overhand technique. None of this underhand. Now, it's very cool. So different families, different communities. Dramatically different from the rest of Canada. Dramatically different within the province. Who are we in British Columbia? Part of that issue, we've just talked about it externally, but part of it is internally. We define ourselves in various ways. And that's where we run into the challenge of diversity, that we've made a big deal in Canada of being tolerant of people who don't look like us. So we get a lot of that kind of multicultural tolerance, but we haven't figured out how to tolerate people who do look like us that don't agree with us. So, and that's the challenge of democracy, is not the challenge of appearances, but the challenge of values. A classic example of that is of this great Canadian movie. This is a typical Canadian movie made by the child of an immigrant from Winnipeg, shooting it in Toronto to make it look like it was Chicago. And if that's not a Canadian movie, I don't know what it is. How many of you, have any of you missed My Big Fat Greek Wedding? You've got to see it. It's a phenomenal statement about the tension in democracy. It's funny, too. The brave Tula wants to marry Ian. Ian is dry like toast. Nick, it's Tula's dad, Nick, not Tula's brother, Nick, or Tula's cousin, Nick, but Tula's dad, says she cannot marry Ian because he is no Greek. So father has this issue that she has to marry the ancestry group. So we see every possible form of male Greekhood dragged through Tula's living room, but Tula wants to marry Ian. The rest of the family don't care about whether Ian's Greek or Yugoslavian or anything, but they do have a debate. Later in the movie, there are 1,000 drunken people noisily partying, and Tula says to her aunt, "You can't cook roast beef for our wedding because Ian is a vegetarian." And the aunt says, "What do you mean he's a vegetarian?" Low voice. And Tula says, "He doesn't eat meat." And the aunt says, "He no eat meat." And the entire party is silenced. Because they don't care what his parentage is, but they care deeply what his values are. How he defines himself. Now, it's easily solved, of course. What does the aunt do? She says, "Is no problem. We eat lamb." There in an image is the problems we now have in diverse communities. It's not about parentage that brings out the conflict anymore. It's about values. It's about what we believe, what we hold. How do you get representation in a value-driven society rather than in an ancestral society? So, for example, now we have this fantasy of food eating. We have fruitarians. Fruitarians are people who will not eat anything from a plant if it harms the plant when it's harvested. So they will eat fruit. Careful. Now, you know I'm from Red Deer, so you know I'm not a fruitarian. So they will not harm a plant by ripping the apple off a tree. They will wait till the apple drops. Then there are vegans who, of course, are totally insensitive to the feelings of plants. So they'll rip a carrot out of the ground and never ask about the carrot's child. Never ask if it's lived a rich and full life. Lacto-vegetarians, lacto-ovo-vegetarians, the cross-dressers of the vegetarian world. Vegetarians who steal your calamari at the bar. Non-red meaters who hang around the kernel. Reasonable people who will eat anything but beets. And people with absolutely no standards whatsoever, because they will also eat beets. So we have this now. We've gone from a situation where people ate because they were starving to a situation where we have tastes. And so we have a society now that's built around food values. So there are the early vegetarians returning from the kill. And it's kind of neat. And, of course, we look at that and we say, "Isn't that cute?" And we all laugh. And then we realize, of course, that there's an ideology of eating now. That people will not share, that they will not eat in the same lunchroom with somebody who's eating something else. They will insist on going to a restaurant where meat is not cooked, or in my case, going to a restaurant where vegetables are not cooked. My mom used to say, "Look, if you can get invited out, eat the meat first, because then if you die, you've had the good stuff." My mom lives in northern Alberta. So the issue is, we've gone from something that was kind of pleasant and amusing to we now draw battle lines around what we eat. We draw battle lines around what we believe. And that is the challenge for our society, is that it's a value-driven society. So people now start making judgments about people's eating habits. So the caption here is, "You're sick, Jesse. Sick, sick, sick." I mean, the cow just wants to have a burger. Why are these other people getting stressed? So this whole issue we're seeing now in our society is much more complicated, because it's not about your parentage. It's about what you believe. And the problem for democracy is we don't very often hold a great strength to our parentage, but we hold a great strength to what we believe. And we get into enormous conflicts with each other, not because we have different ancestries, but because we have strongly held beliefs. So what we have now in British Columbia is not only a spatial diversity, a religious diversity, an ancestry diversity, we also have diversity of values. Now, some of this stuff is good. This is a magazine called Rice Paper. It's Asian Arts, Canadian Culture. I'm not very much into the culture, but one of the cool things is they have a car section. And I grew up in Red Deer, Alberta, and I like cars. So I can go out and hang with the guys from Rice Paper, because they know the guys from Grad 5, and that we can talk louvers and hubcaps and chrome maggies and all of that stuff and kind of share our values. So that the difference now is no longer... There's a lot of stuff about young Asian males racing cars on the street, and the whole issue became, well, you know, gee, it's something Asians do, and I guess nobody grew up in Red Deer in the 50s. So the values are becoming much stronger. And so our challenge becomes an ethical challenge now. Values are what we believe in. The ethical challenge is how do we treat people whose values we don't share? And that's the challenge for democracy. We all have deeply held values. The question is how we treat other people who don't hold them and how we would like them to treat us. For example, here is Vancouver's leading brand. Good old Dave. And he had a daughter. And his daughter is referred to as the little green sprout, which has to be the most condescending, patronizing thing you could ever say about a person. But his daughter, the daughter of the great David Suzuki, ate a chicken sandwich once. And the defining statement is, from somebody else's, you can't be an environmentalist and a meat eater too. So again, drawing lines, drawing very hard, very fine, very fundamental lines about human beings based on values and behavior. We can buy at our local financial institutions health care insurance for our cat. 22% of the children in the United States of America do not have health care, and we can buy health care insurance for our cats. That's really cool. I think that's absolutely great. People love their cats. There must be money made in it because people have these cute... For a dog, I could see it. Oh, yeah, shit. It's huge. We're too rich. I used to work on housing projects for people who lived in the dump in Bangkok. None of them were interested in buying health care insurance for their pets. We have a tremendous luxury. So this is okay. People like to have pets. That's cool. That's groovy. We can live with that. And the Catholic Church comes out and says that it's morally wrong, that pets have no souls or rights. Okay. And God help them if they eat a chicken sandwich, because they can't be environmentalists either. So the problem in our world now in terms of democracy is we're drawing a lot of hard lines, but they're different hard lines from the ones we used to draw. What about diversity within our province? Should I stop now and ask for questions or just keep going? Keep going. Okay, cool. In terms of diversity within our province, the big gap in British Columbia is at the mountains on the North Shore. This is a pattern of growth in Canada. You can see it's a pattern throughout Canada. The sparsely settled areas are the 90% of the country that's empty. But if you take a look around, significant population declines in rural communities, no matter where you go throughout Canada, and in the States. It's a big challenge. Of the population growth between 1996 and 2001 in the census, of half of the regional districts in this province, half of the local government, the regional government areas, lost population. Absolutely fewer number of people. Skeena, Queen Charlotte lost 13%, Mount Waddington 10%, Kitimat-Stikine 6%. Of the ones that grew, the only ones that grew faster than the province were the Fraser Valley, Greater Vancouver, Squamish-Lillooet. And why does Squamish-Lillooet grow? because Ross and his buddies were up there boarding. It's a great place. It's like the Australian embassy in the winter and the central Okanagan. But if you take a look, even the ones that grew slower, still grew, but slower than the average, they're all located in a very specific part of the province. They're all located in the Trans-Canada Corridor. So those high amenity, attractive regions in the south central part of the province, they grew everywhere else in the province, down in the Kootenays, and in the northern three quarters of the province, every community lost population. If we take the next step, all but four regions in British Columbia lost population of young people, people under the age of 45 moving out. So that when we look at the hopes and dreams and aspirations of young people in the province of British Columbia, many of them are not finding them met in the communities that they live in. They are leaving for Alberta, for other provinces, significant declining younger population. Some coming to the southwest corner, many leaving the province. This causes a huge problem for these communities for a geeky economic reason, but there's a thing called a demand threshold. The minimum number of people you need to support an intensive care unit or a specialist physician or a pharmacy or a gas station. And as soon as your population declines to that point, you start losing these establishments, which means more people leave. And so the communities go into a downward spiral. So this is the demand threshold idea. If we take the diversity of the labor force, the range of things that people do in communities, and plot them in Canada, for all of the communities in Canada, can see that the big diversity is at Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Edmonton, Calgary, the big cities. They've got the population to support a lot of stuff. Ottawa, I just think Ottawa is so great. Ottawa looks like a pulp town. I mean, it has a single industry in terms of the data, so it's not very diverse. If we take a look then, there's a point of about 50,000 people that if you can get over the hurdle, you can generally weather the storms. Might be tough, but you can weather the storms. But if your population's below 50,000 people, as soon as you start to lose population, you start seeing shops and establishments closing. So communities, these small communities that make up the vast majority of our landscape, certainly not of our population, but of our landscape, are very vulnerable to economic cycles. And so one of the things we find when we take a look in British Columbia is that the average distance to specialist physicians, once you get out of the lower mainland, jumps. So if you live in Terrace or Prince Rupert, Williams Lake, Quesnel, Smithers, you are a lot further from care than if you live in the lower mainland or southern Vancouver Island. So it's issues for these communities as they see their populations decline and their support establishments close. It causes significant trauma in these communities. And then they hear us talking about spending $2.3 billion on a RAV line, and they scratch their heads sometimes. Sometime, if you want to have fun, ask somebody in Terrace what they think of BC Place. Carrying on. Increase in bankruptcies. This is the increase in bankruptcy rates in British Columbia, 2002, 2003 together, divided by 95, 96. Look at the communities where personal bankruptcies are skyrocketing. Campbell River, Cranbrook, Terrace, wherever, Port Alberni, Quesnel, Prince Rupert, Williams Lake, Powell River, Prince George, Courtney, Abbotsford, Fort St. John, Dawson Creek, Penticton, Chilliwack. Things are not really good in a lot of our communities. People are going bankrupt at an increasing rate. Some communities are doing fine, oil and gas. Other communities, fishing communities, doing poorly. If we take a look at percentage of the population on EI, Skeena, Queen Charlotte, Central Coast, Stikine, Kitimat, Stikine, Mount, all the coastal forest regions, Alberni, Clayquot, Central Kootenay, all the way down, significant portion of the... But Capital Regional District, Greater Vancouver Regional District, the Cowichan Valley, the Sunshine Coast... much smaller percentage. And then Fort Nelson, Liard, because we've got great oil and gas industry up there. Population 25 to 54% receiving income assistance. Same pattern. Skeena, Queen Charlotte's, Kitimat, Stikine, Alberni, Clayquot. Well-being in this province is not uniformly spread around. Now, I was at a meeting of the Fraser Basin Council, and somebody looked at this kind of information and said, well, we've just got to figure out which one of these communities are viable and shut the rest down. And so I asked them if we were going to shoot their dogs first, because you don't want to have the dogs in the city. The issue is that while you can come up with a lot of clinical solutions to these kinds of problems, you're talking about people's homes, their lives, their visions, their dreams, what they kind of look forward into their future. And it's rough in many of these places economically right now. Their education system, the opportunities for the future are driven by education. Percentage of students below standard in grade 10 math in Greater Vancouver Regional District is 21%. It's 42% in Kitimat-Stikine. It's 29% in Fraser-Fort George. So we're also seeing a differing of the future in terms of the ability of our education system to uniformly distribute education in the province. If we take a look at diversity, this gives you sort of a rough idea in Western Canada of how those small communities sort of distribution along an average line. But if we take a look in British Columbia, we see another one of those unique features about British Columbia. Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec do not have the same propensity to have regional service centers like we do. Look at above that line, Kelowna, Nanaimo, Kamloops, Vernon, Cranbrook, Penticton, Chilliwack. You don't see those on the prairies. You don't see a sort of another. The prairies, you sort of see an Edmonton, Calgary, a Red Deer, and then maybe Lethbridge. Here we have a very significant number of small regional serving centers distributed throughout the province. So a different economic structure than we see in other parts of Canada. Vancouver Island, I highlighted the ones in Vancouver Island to show the kind of range you see on the island. So they have less diversity, less weathering power in their community. They also have dramatically different economies. Makes sense. But for example, the average number of beef cattle per square mile of farmland, when you get up to the interior, they're able to relate a little bit better to the issue of Alberta farmers than they are the people in the lower mainland. So that when we had mad cow disease, all of that sort of stuff, it's a sort of so what to people in the lower mainland. It's a critical issue for people in these communities. So different economies, they tend to be more resource-driven economies. This is just a chart I love because I just go far out. It's an attempt to show, as I say, diversity is so hard to show, but it's an attempt to show how the island communities are so dependent on primary resources. So you see where they've got a disproportionate share of employment is logging, pulp mills, farming, construction, sawmills. They don't look like the lower mainland, which has sort of a uniform distribution throughout. So different economies affected by different features. And things aren't good in many of these communities. This is the BC exports of wild salmon, 1988 to 2001, current dollars, so it's not adjusted for inflation. And we're talking about a quarter. We're talking about, of the fishing communities, a quarter. They're living on a quarter of the income they had in 1988. So the issue, of course, is they shift in some communities to farmed salmon. But it's not the same people. It's not the same communities. And they keep saying to me, they call us the people in 604. You folks in 604, you don't understand. You won't let us catch the wild one. You won't let us grow the farmed ones. What do you want us to do for a living? And so they see themselves in conflict with their traditional ways of life and their economies and our ways of life. And what they generally get as a response from down south is, so what? Because 57% of us live in the lower mainland. We're not really affected by what affects their communities. So we tend to be indifferent. We tend to think that in British Columbia, our cities are the engines of, in the lower mainland, the city is the engine of growth. So we see things in our newspaper like our cities are the growing economic engines. They need more power. They're engines of the economy where 80% of the people live and produce wealth. And we see these statements like Vancouver produces 53% of gross domestic product. So Vancouver's sort of a manly region in its own mind. Then we see that So we see this image, 53% of British Columbia's GDP from Vancouver. Then we see that the same data says that Calgary and Edmonton produce 64% of Alberta's GDP, and we go, hold it. I thought they had an oil and gas industry there. And so we take a look at what the data are actually saying, and what it's really saying is that Vancouver is the dining car of economic growth. The reason we have 53% of British Columbia's GDP is we have 53% of British Columbia's population, and GDP is overwhelmingly comprised of consumption. So we're a feedlot, if you like. So we go through and we say, well, where does British Columbia, what is British Columbia's GDP? Well, $80 billion is consumption, mainly in urban areas, government spending mainly in urban areas, investment mainly in urban areas, imports are consumed mainly in urban areas, so of course urban areas dominate GDP. The question is, where do the exports come from? Exports are important because they give us the money to spend. And it was quite a different pattern in British Columbia. So here's an economic model. It's used widely at SFU. I don't know what they use at UBC, but there you go. There's a model of the economy. And what exports do is they bring money into the bathtub. That's the water flowing into your economy. And imports is money flowing out of your economy. So every time you buy an orange, you're shipping money out of your economy. Every time you sell a cappuccino to a tourist from Akron, Ohio, you're bringing money into the economy. And all of the other things in our economy, government spending, consumption, investment, is driven solely by us having more water coming in than water's going out. So what we want to know is, where does British Columbia earn its money? Because we want to keep the level of water adequate in the bathtub, because it might be an embarrassment for Clint. Of course, we know it wouldn't be an embarrassment, because he's got the gun, right? Okay, in the bathtub. Exports matter because it's where we get the money to buy Merle Haggard records, aspirins, tea, laptops, organic fair trade tofu, and all of that other stuff that we don't produce, we need to export to buy it. Where does the money come from in British Columbia? Half of the money that we spend in British Columbia grows on trees. It comes from the forests. So that if we take a look at British Columbia's annual, the average annual exports to other countries, wood, pulp, paper, and forest products, 43%. Services, including tourism, 21%. That's our breakdown of exports. If we simply add fuels and pulp and paper to get wood, pulp, and forest products, half of the economy comes from those two industries, and neither of those industries are in metropolitan regions in British Columbia. So the issue for British Columbia, this is how we did the math, is that we certainly generate wealth in the metropolitan regions. The lower main, well, Vancouver, Victoria sell $4 billion of tourists, of services every year to other parts of the world. So we do have significant exports, but the non-metropolitan regions sell more in the fuel, simply in, well, energy resources, than the service exports the entire lower mainland. The value of forest-based exports from non-metropolitan regions in the province, forestry alone, exceeds all of the exports of metropolitan regions. So who's paying the bill in British Columbia are the resource regions. Neither good nor bad, but you can see the resentment that starts to build up between regions when they are the source of the economy and we're telling them that they can't farm fish. So that in current dollar values, goods and services, metropolitan regions account for 29% of the exports, but have 57% of the population. Non-metropolitan regions account for 71% of the exports, but have 43% of the population. So a tension comes in British Columbia because of how we earn our incomes. So city-states, the metropolitan regions, they're great. They do contribute to the economy, but don't tell it to somebody who's laid off in the forest industry. Other issues, Population growth in community in British Columbia, percentage of the population who lived in the same community between 2001 and 1996, highest in those resource regions, Alberni, Clayquot, Powell River, Fraser, Fort George, lowest in Squamish, Lillooet, down in the southeast. Of course, we would expect that because in the regions whose populations are declining, you either leave or stay in the same house. You're not moving around in the real estate. In the other parts where the population's growing, they have a significant influx of people, so more of the people are moving within the housing stock. So the communities only look more stable because nobody's moving to them. One-person households, we have this image kind of the one-person household dominating in Vancouver, people living in apartments, etc. Sort of true, but Stikine, Capital Regional District, Okanagan, Similkameen, Kootenay Boundary, the retirement regions are where we find the one-person households. Some in Vancouver, but the retirement region. And then the very relatively few one-person households in the resource regions. Couples with children in the household as percentage of all households. Clearly those resource regions up north, highest percentage of couples with families, and then the retirement communities, Okanagan, Similkameen, Capital, Nanaimo, Sunshine Coast, Powell River, those kinds of regions having small percentage of their households with children present. So again, a diversity within the province in terms of the issues that people are concerned with. Couple without children, again, where we would expect it, the retirement communities have the highest percentage of households without children, and it tends to be in the coastal communities, plus Vancouver, interestingly, that have relatively small number of households without children. So a different complexity. Aboriginal population, 60% of the Central Coast population, 40% of Stikine region, 6% of Skeena, Queen Charlotte, those populations, very significant First Nations communities. Greater Vancouver, Central Okanagan, Capital, relatively small proportion. So again, a different set of diversity measures if we look at the First Nations population. We've seen this already. Immigrant populations go to the metropolitan regions. The reason they go to the metropolitan regions is they're the communities there to help them integrate into the economy, the local economy, and also their growing regions. If we take a look at where our populations in terms of first generation, that is the people who were born outside Canada, second generation, the children of people who were born out of Canada, third generation people whose both parents were born in Canada, we see, again, an anticipated pattern that it's the Central Coast, Northern Rockies, Peace River, Mount Waddington has that highest proportion of third plus generation, and the smallest proportion tend to be in the growing regions. Median age, as I'm looking at communities rather than regional districts now, Parksville is the oldest community. Fort St. John is the youngest community. Again, a pattern that is a rural pattern. It's not a metropolitan pattern. The metropolitan region sits about in the middle, but rather the Parksvilles, the Penticton's, Powell Rivers, Vernon's, Courtney's, Alberni's, relatively old populations. The Terrace, the Fort St. John, the Prince George, the Rupert's, relatively young populations, plus Abbotsford. Now, Abbotsford pops up because, of course, it is where people in the lower mainland who have children, by and large, can afford to buy starter housing. So it tends to have a younger population as well. Fertility rates, one of the other factors that affect the youth of a population is the birth rate, and we can see these are health regions. The Northwest, Peace Layard, Fraser Valley, Caribou, relatively high birth rates, almost at the replacement level. Vancouver Health Region, typical woman has 1.2 children during her lifetime in the Vancouver Health Region. So a tremendous difference in birthing patterns of families being started. That was 1991. 2001, a similar pattern, but not nearly as different, and all birth rates dramatically lower. So that we see in places like the Caribou, Thompson, Nicola, Northwest, Northern Interior, a 30% drop in the propensity of people to have children. Again, the people's expectations in those communities about the future of those communities are not ones that drive them, by and large, to be overly enthusiastic about having children because of the economic prospects in those communities. Life expectancy at birth is highest in Richmond, lowest in the Northern Interior. people from the northern interior should not all move to Richmond. They won't live any longer. The issue with Richmond is if you want to take a perfect middle-class community, there it is. It doesn't have a downtown east side. It doesn't have loggers and people working in mills. You go up into the northern interior, the most dangerous profession you can be engaged in is logging. So it has an impact on life expectancy in those communities. So different work basis. That's a population profile. It's how we look at populations in terms of their age composition. You can see that's the provincial population. But that's Okanagan-Similkameen. That's Oliver, Soyuz, etc. The oldest regional district in Canada. There are almost no young people. I think the young people they have were hitchhiking through and kind of got caught up in the action or something, or fell asleep on census day. Very, very much a top-heavy age profile. Peace River, the youngest population profile, relatively few older people, significant component of younger population. Greater Vancouver looks pretty well like the province does, as we would anticipate, because it's 54% of the province, so it dominates the statistics. Fraser Valley Regional District tends to look a little bit more like the Peace River, again, it being a family community. What's the demographic future forecasted for some of these regions? This is a thing called the dependency ratio, the number of people 60 plus per 1,000 people, 20 to 59, a ratio of the working population to the retired population, if you like. And as you can see right now, it tends to be the south that is oldest. That is Kootenay, Vancouver Coast, Thompson, Okanagan. The north, with those higher birth rates, has a younger population, tends to be much younger. But if we run forecasts into the future, which when you think about it is about the only place we would do a forecast, I like to do a forecast of the past. Don't buy Nortel. Short the American dollar 18 months ago. Significant growth in all of our communities as that bulge that sat in the middle of that age profile ages, as we age. So significant growth in the older population, all of our communities. But on a percentage basis, the most dramatic increases will be in the northern communities. So they're caught in this dilemma of not having a growing younger population, the people living there getting older, and in many cases not. Sell your house in Terrace and come on down and buy a place in Vancouver. A place being a parking stall. So can't get out of those communities, not having enough people in the community to support the health care, younger people leaving, dramatic issues of delivering services and health care in these aging northern and resource communities. BC Stats, the first one was, this is BC Stats, a look at it spatially, where those regions outside of the Trans-Canada Corridor tend to be much younger right now. They'll still be younger in the future, but they see the most dramatic change in those patterns. I have another 220 slides. But I think in this film, the clip we saw at the beginning, your attendance rate was really good. I forget what the other one was because my age group remembering one thing is pretty good. Your staying power is admirable, but if you have any questions, I'll take them now because probably on a Saturday night at 8:15, a couple of you have something better to do. So are there any questions?
It's not a question. I just want to say thank you very much. I enjoyed this Saturday night more than I've enjoyed any of the other Saturday nights I've been in here. You've made me laugh and forget my tiredness from today because we worked so hard.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much. Wow. I haven't had a round of applause like that since I was giving away free Shania tickets.
Question over there.
Just a question, please.
When do we get to see the rest of the slides?
In the fall.
In the fall. Let me tell you what the rest of the slides do, very briefly. what I do is you take that badly trimmed Christmas tree that is our age profile. And the typical British Columbian is a 42-year-old, which means in 30 years, the typical British Columbian without immigration is a 72-year-old. And so the challenge for British Columbia is how do we pay for that 72-year-old's health care? Because when you're a 42-year-old, you're a net contributor to health care. When you're a 72-year-old, you're a net beneficiary. It's not good or bad, it's just a fact. And so the issue is with a below-the-replacement-level birth rate, by 2007 in Canada as a whole, our labor force will stop growing without immigration. So all of the issues I talked about at the beginning, the challenges of diverse religions, values, beliefs, we become more diverse, it becomes more difficult. But on the other hand, it becomes a lot more fun because Widemouth Mason just kicks ass compared to Humphrey and the Dump Trucks. So that's the forecast. I mean, it's the same issue in Europe, all over Canada, even Alberta. If Alberta did not have a continual supply of young people from Saskatchewan and British Columbia, they would have significant problems. We all are going to have to face the reality that a 1.5 birth rate doesn't generate replacements for us. Yeah, I'm chairing this session. Okay.
I could really use some of this information in some proposals that I'm writing, so I'm wondering if I could have a copy of your presentation.
It's on the website.
Oh, is it? Okay. And then just at the beginning, you were talking about how most of the population kind of stretches from the coast over to Flintstone Village, and I'm just wondering if you could give me a synopsis of the demographics of Flintstone Village.
You mean Flintstone Village? Yeah, I can, actually. The Chilliwack CA, the demographic profile. But it's younger. It's not as young as Abbotsford, because Abbotsford has been captured by the Vancouver growth. It's more Mennonite because of its ancestry. 1961, the second language in British Columbia was German. So that influences the pattern, dairy farming, that kind of agriculture. Strong contrast with Abbotsford with the perspective of immigration. Abbotsford has very, very strong, healthy Sikh community, and it's not moving up the valley yet. It's starting to, but it's something that's localized with the housing market. The real break point, though, we know where Chilliwack's going. And how many people have been to Flintstone Village? Cool. I'm with my people. It's cool. The real break point, though, is it doesn't go to Hope. Hope really doesn't belong to the Lower Mainland, and that's why we close it off at Flintstone Village. So a very interesting community and change because it's the next Abbotsford. So, and we've got some, if I'm sure not everybody's interested in that, but we did a little forecast for the different communities in the Lower Mainland, which I think is on our site, but if not, my email's on the site, and you can just email and I'll blast it to you.
Okay, we promised everybody, David, that we'd kind of end around 8:15. If that's, and I kind of sense that we'll bring you back. Okay, I think that's for sure.
Thank you.
I found this really enormously informative, but there's one slide I didn't like at all, and you'll have to take it off your site. And that's the one where you have the median age by the various cities in BC, and no matter what city I live in, I'm old.
Just wait.
David, you're here because quite a number of members, not just FW, but others, indicated they would like something. They would like to better understand the diversity of British Columbia. And I don't think anyone could have packed more into an hour and a half than you did. Susan said it right. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.